best place for below average stars.
Hello there, and welcome to the Star Wars Show, the best place for below average Star Wars. I am the Geordie Jedi Pete.
I'm Jason Hondo-Ling.
And I'm the Canon Junkie XL Ian.
And we are back to talk more Star Wars The Bad Batch. We are obviously reviewing Season 3, and we've got three episodes to review for you today. We've got Episode 10, Identity Crisis, Episode 11, Point of No Return, and Episode 12, A Juggernaut. So if you've not seen any of those episodes, please obviously pause the podcast right now. Go over and watch those on Disney Plus, where they are available to stream anytime. And then come back and listen to us a deep dive, get sweaty and spoil it all, because we are going to be deep diving, talking in detail about these three episodes. So going to dive straight in with Identity Crisis, which is episode 10. So this was available to stream and watch from April 3rd, 2024. Before I dive into sort of a description of what the episode's like, I just want to go to both of you first. So we'll go to you first, Ian. Obviously, this episode, Identity Crisis, is very much from the point of view of sort of the Empire and from Amiri. And I just wanted how you felt about the sort of the shift in tone and the shift of the eyes we're seeing the story through, the narration almost.
I really liked it. I liked changing it up and getting a bit more perspective from the obviously the Imperial side. And Dr. Carr is a character who we don't know where true allegiance lies. She seems to have a lot of loyalty to Omega and that. So it was interesting. I do like those episodes where we do get a different perspective. In Star Wars Rebels, I think it was called Through Imperial Eyes, one of the Star Wars Rebels episodes that was predominantly from the Imperial side through Agent Kallus, and that was one of my favorite episodes of Rebels, to be fair. So I did like it when we got a different look at the story.
And the same question to you, Jason. Just obviously the change in tone and the change in the point of view we get from this episode. How did it feel for you?
Yeah, no, I like it when it sort of takes a different look at what we've already been established and the story that we're going through. And I find Emery's quite an interesting character. So to see it from her point of view and to see the way, you know, we've already seen in previous episodes with the closeness that she was starting to get to Omega, that she's now sort of starting to see that maybe everything that's going on here isn't quite right. So to see that sort of journey was really good. And it's like Ian said, you know, it's something that the guys at Star Wars seem to manage to do very well, is that they can show things from a different angle, and everything's not as black and white. There are grey areas.
Indeed, I think for me it was a nice change. You know, I think we've been with the gang, with the Bad Batch themselves, you know, from the beginning, you know, sort of in two halves with Hunter and Wrecker, and then obviously with Crosshair and Omega. Then we finally came together, and then this episode, you know, we're giving those guys a bit of breathing space, and we're diving into this looming threat of Mount Tantus and obviously Hemlock's super secret research project Necromancer, and sort of diving up here a bit more, which I thought was really cool to do, and a sort of a nice little place to do it. Episode 10, you know, sort of two thirds of the way through the 15 episode season, and sort of a nice place to do it, especially when you consider what's next, as we'll get into. I'll just give a brief description of the episode and then we'll dive in. So obviously Nala Se has been imprisoned by Hemlock. Obviously, as we've seen before in the season, Omega and Crosshair escape, and sort of she's got the blame for that. And you know, Amiri Carr sort of reluctantly being promoted to the new head lead scientist of Project Necromancer. But we sort of see how Amiri Carr sort of, she's a little bit disillusioned, I suppose, as she sees more and more of Project Necromancer and the Vault. The Vault is where, obviously, you know, there's four sensitive children here, is what we learn. And they're being tested on because they might have high M counts. And they're being threatened in quite a cold manner I would say, and sort of it's a bit of a shock for Amiri Carr as she gets used to that. We also get a lot of tragedy in this episode where, you know, we see a mother and a child, and the child is force sensitive, and the child uses the force out in the streets just to, you know, causing some trouble amongst the shopkeepers and the storekeepers. And obviously someone reports it to the Empire. It's actually Cad Bane who comes and sort of steals the child as a bounty away from its mother and sells it to the Empire. And we get to see, you know, Amiri Carr gets to see that up front and is part of that deal, which I think, again, gives that quite a shock. Going in the background of this, we've also got Tarkin's threatening to take away Hemlock's funding, you know, if we don't see the desired results soon. And then CX2, our super-duper clone, at the end of the episode, reports to Hemlock that he is close to finding Omega, and he's obviously learned that because of Omega's connection to Fee, which is learned by torturing our old friend Sid. So a lot to digest there, and it's sort of a, you know, even though this episode's short, you know, I think a lot's going on when it comes to, there's no Bad Batch involved. There's quite a lot going on, I suppose, all over. I suppose we'll go to you first, Jason. Just what were your thoughts on sort of Amiri Carr's take up of the job to be the lead scientist, and then sort of how she deals with sort of the coldness that she learns about what they actually do to the subjects of this operation, and also the age of the subject?
Yeah, I think it's quite an interesting episode in that, obviously, at the beginning, although she's she wants to take on this responsibility, and she's sort of been, you can tell that she's been pushing for this for a while. But then, obviously, as she learns more about what the project is, I think it's quite shocking for her. And also, obviously, the fact that she is a clone, she's sort of suddenly realising, yeah, we're all a bit of a commodity here. And, you know, they're not being treated as people. They're being treated as a means to an end. That's quite an interesting, we go through quite a journey in the whole episode of, you know, we get a lot of stuff sort of confirmed about what's been going on, what the project entails. And at the same time, you know, we're seeing it through the eyes of that character, and not through, you know, just watching events as the story unfolds. So, yeah, I think this is quite a special one in the way it's done. Obviously, seeing the return of Cad Bane and the involvement that he's still got, which again harkens back to, obviously, episodes from the Clone Wars, where obviously Cad Bane was hunting down Jedi or Force-sensitive children. For the Empire, or obviously at the time, it wasn't the Empire as we knew it. It was the forming of the Empire.
Definitely. Let's go to you, Ian. Your thoughts on sort of Amiri Carr's take up of the job of head scientist, and how she deals with sort of the things she finds out about what actually, the actual details of Project Necromancer, which maybe she wasn't aware of, and how those can be quite questionable, I suppose.
Yeah, I think as a scientist anyway, she's naturally curious just to see what they are working on. It's obviously a big project. It's Dr. Hemlock's primary focus to figure it out. So, you know, I'm not surprised that she's intrigued by what the project is and why she would like to take up the reins. I think she'd also like to take up the reins, obviously, to obviously find out what he's been up to, but then she could use that to help the kids. We see it in the episode, obviously, where she leaves the doll for one of the young kids that's locked away in the vault. So yeah, no, it's a really moral grey. It's not really a moral grey area. They're holding people against their will. So yeah, it's not good. But I don't think she is evil, to be fair, either.
Definitely. and sort of you talk about evil and questionable. You know, I suppose we don't know how the children that are in the vault on Mount Tantan's got there, but you know, we learn that this child they've just acquired, they've pretty very much acquisition by stealing and kidnapping the child from their own mother, from its own mother. What were your thoughts like when this happened, and it sort of happens right in front of us? I was quite shocked, I will say that, and you know, it's quite tragic to see, you know, especially when it sort of reminded me of, like, you know, when you see it in the news about child abductions, things like that, like, hit me quite hard real life when you read about real people how it affects in you know, Kira and our reality, and then Kira is happening in the Star Wars universe. What are you first, Jason? Was that, you know, and Jason obviously is as a father as well, sort of, you know, how did that hit you when you see Cad Bane steal this child?
Yeah, it's something that this season of Bad Batch has gone really, really dark, and it's not holding back on pulling the punches. You know, when you see this episode, and as you say, and Cad Bane has been created as this character that, you know, he will do pretty much anything for a bounty. He's the ultimate bounty hunter, really. He doesn't care what he has to do. As long as he's going to get paid, he will do whatever they ask him to do. Which probably makes him one of the most scariest characters in some ways that we've ever had. And then you watch this episode, and like you say, you know, to kill the parent, to take the child, and such a young child, it sort of highlights also something that sort of came out in Rise of Skywalker, where the First Order were obviously kidnapping children for their stormtrooper ranks. So it's something that's very dark and very much part of it. But in this episode, it is put out there, and this is how bad they can really be. Yeah, as a parent, you know, it'd be the worst nightmare to have a child taken. Obviously, in this way, in order to lose the child, the parents lost their life. And yeah, it's a real gut wrencher. And I think hats off to them for not shying away from these episodes of showing just how dark it's going.
Definitely. I think one thing I did pick up on when I analyze it after, so like immediately I was sort of shocked, sad, outraged, you know, like it's very tragic. But after sort of a while thinking about it, I was able to think more about the sort of the details. And one thing I thought was, like, you know, the Empire didn't come in and take this child themselves. Like a bounty hunter came and took the child, and then they've done the deal somewhere else. It looks like they've done the deal in the darkness of a Coruscant space station, maybe. So what I got the vibes of. So, you know, goes to that, you know, the Empire is not the big bad that we've seen in New Hope yet. You know, the Senate still exists, and there's still some opposition in the Senate, as we learned in Season 2. And that's how Rampart lost his job, I suppose. So the Empire have to do things a little bit secretly, where I think in the future we'll see them do things more blatant. So it doesn't make it any less tragic, I suppose, but the fact that they were using the bounty hunter to steal the child rather than just scorning themselves and taking the child, I thought was a good marker to show us just where the Empire's at the minute. They can't do everything in plain sight yet. They don't have total control, or maybe that's... They do have total control, but I suppose that they want to give the illusion that they're still good guys, if that makes sense. So by taking a child in the open, obviously that wouldn't work. They're not at the point where they're all powerful yet, where they can just do what they want and not risk people talking about it. I don't know what your thoughts are on that, Ian, if you agree with that.
Yeah, no, I agree with your thing. They can't at this point in the timeline, they can't be as overtly evil as we see them later on, because then it could lead to problems. They haven't got the Death Star to obviously try and enforce power, and they don't have, although they do have a military from the Clone Wars, they don't have the military that they eventually will reach, where they have thousands upon thousands of Star Destroyers and all that type of thing, where they can enforce their will. Obviously, we'll see that when they start to expand their power in the coming years. Like when you said about the kids being kidnapped, it's very interesting, actually, because the Inquisitorius has a similar project that we've seen in stuff like Jedi Fallen Order and the Darth Vader comics by Charles Soule. They had a program where they obviously went and collected Force-sensitive children. So it's interesting whether the Inquisitorius aren't ready at this point to do that, or whether Dr. Hemlock is doing this off the reservation, so to speak, and he's just going about himself to try and get some M-count subjects. I also think this could be the answer to how, obviously, Grogu comes to the attention of the Empire. I think that could be a good... it'd be funny if he just was one of the kids that was in the cell. That would have been a funny tie-in.
Definitely. I think for me, I think Hemlock's doing his own thing here. Because, when he was talking to Tarkin, and Tarkin tells me, we'll have to cut the funding. And Hemlock very much plays the Palpatine card, like the Emperor would want this research. And obviously, you got to remember Project Necromancer. When the Emperor visited, he came sort of with some guards and with some sort of pomp and in a party, but like it wasn't a lot. And you've got to think that, when we get to Return of the Jedi, when the Emperor dies, everyone thinks that he's dead. So I'm going to assume that Vader certainly doesn't know about Project Necromancer, never does. And obviously the Inquisitorius are obviously under the command of Darth Vader. So I'm going to assume that this is just something that's running. The Emperor's running this on the side. So sort of the Inquisitorius are stealing Force-sensitive children for something different, doing something different, as we learn in those comic books and in Star Wars Rebels. But then we see here Hemlock is getting them through bounty hunters and for different reasons. I don't know what your thoughts are on that, Jason, if you sort of agree with that standpoint, or if you think there's maybe some issues with that thought process.
Yeah, obviously, this is very much the Emperor's secret project, I think. And I think that's becoming more and more clear. This is sort of heading towards explaining to everyone how the Emperor could just suddenly reappear. Obviously, we knew that it was cloning technology, but it's sort of, how is he going to come back in a body and, still be as powerful as he was when he was the Sith Lord? So obviously, yeah, it's a problem that only he really understands and wants to solve. So it is very much hidden and everything. The point that you guys made there, obviously, that the Imperials aren't doing everything as overtly and out there as evil as they have, as we see them as the films move on. But the other thing is, obviously, this is, we know roughly this is the early days of the Empire after Order 66. And obviously they're transitioning from the clones to the stormtroopers, and that they haven't necessarily got all of the, all of the facilities available to them as well, which is why they're going to these guns for hire. But also, I think by using Cad Bane, Darth Sidious is going to know that basically this is his best way of keeping things on the QT, because Bane's not going to tell anyone, because let's face it, Bane doesn't want loads of bounty hunters all looking for Force-sensitive kids, because it's an income for him. So he's got a reason to protect the secrecy as well, purely on his own grounds. So it's clever use. We know that Darth Sidious, or the Emperor, he's always one step ahead, and he's always planning that little, like when the clones fought, they'd managed to stop the clones being retired, and then he'd been manipulating, and what they'd done to stop it had actually pushed forward his plan and allowed him to get the decision. And we see that in obviously the films with Jar Jar Binks. So this is planning, and this is the Emperor putting all of his plans together to get what he wants. And he's going to keep it secret, because in the long run, he wants to be the all-powerful.
definitely. You know what your thoughts were sort of on the end of the episode, you know, when we hear about CX2, you know, reports that he's, you know, he's going to find Omega, he's very close, and we see that he's, you know, used Sid to get information about Fee.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. I saw some, like, discourse whether Sid would be willing to give that information willingly. I think she would. I think if it meant her saving her own skin, we've seen her betray the batch before, and now she's betraying her friend's Fee, which tracks for the character. So, yeah, no, I think Sid would have given the information up willingly to obviously save her own skin. And it's no real great surprise from that character.
Jason, thoughts on Sid giving up the information on Fee to CX2?
Yeah, it's like Ian said, it fits with the character, you know, self-preservation. When we look at what she did previously, and obviously, you know, her and a Bad Batch have a complicated relationship. You know, that they've never fully trusted her, and she's used them to get what she wants. Sometimes she's shown a bit of loyalty, but I think if it meant her own survival, she'd probably sell her own grandmother.
Indeed. Just want your final thoughts on these. So, I mean, I don't think you've commented much on it, Ian, but what was your thoughts on seeing Cad Bane and how Cad Bane was in this episode? Did you enjoy seeing him back, and were you happy with it?
I always enjoy seeing Cad Bane. He's one of my favourite bounty hunters. Obviously loved it when he was brought into the Book of Boba Fett as well as live action. No, it's always good to see him. He will always be a miserable like scumbag, and I mean that in a good way, because he is. That's who he is. And he doesn't care what he does. He doesn't care who he has to hurt. He will get his target and get paid. And that is Cad Bane in a nutshell. And yeah, no, always glad to see him. He's a great character. He's one of the coolest designs, I think, in Star Wars for a bounty hunter. And yeah, no, just hugely excited any time he appears in a show.
Jason, any closing thoughts on Identity Crisis before we move on?
Just, you know, it's one of the very interesting episodes. It moves the story on quite nicely. It gives us an extra look at what's going on at Mount Tantiss, and in particular what Hemlock's up to. And I think it starts to show, you know, that we're now starting to see what the Emperor really wants to achieve.
Definitely. And just finally from you, Ian, sort of, you know, this episode, it hits hard, you know, it's quite tragic. It deals with some really sort of adult themes and, you know, scary themes. And obviously ends with that sort of, that bad feeling of, you know, the Empire's coming for Omega and the Bad Batch now, we know that. And they've got some information now that you can get them through Fee. What was your thoughts at the end of sort of the impending feeling of what is coming?
I thought this is really, really not going to end well. CX2, he's very determined to find his target, and it's not going to... I really enjoy this. It sounds weird because it's quite a dark era in Star Wars, but I really do enjoy the Dark Times era in Star Wars, where there is undoubtable darkness everywhere, and this is what obviously ignites the spark of rebellion. So yeah, I really enjoy this part of the timeline. I think it's good it's been explored. So yeah, no. And then, like I said, I thought Pabu is not long for this world.
Let's move on to the next episode. Episode 11, Point of No Return, which also aired on April 3rd. So it was sort of a double header. So we had some tragedy in the first episode that aired on this date. And then were we going to get a bit happier in the next episode? Let's find out. So it starts off with CX2 sneaks aboard Fee's ship and retrieves Pabu's location from Fee's navigational computer. Concerned about the risk of staying on Pabu, the Bad Batch are preparing to leave the planet when CX2 arrives and confirms their presence. He destroys the Marauder in pretty spectacular fashion, seriously injures Wrecker in the process, and he calls the Empire for reinforcements. With their means of escape cut off, the rest of the Bad Batch evade their pursuers, while Hunter tries to steal an Imperial gunship. Obviously, the Empire arrive while this is all ongoing, and you know, gunships are deployed. There is Star Destroyers in the atmosphere, and there is troops on the ground. Hunter gets shot down by CX-2 while trying to steal one of these Imperial gunships. The Empire start, you know, burning down houses and really intimidating and terrorizing the people of Pabu, to the point where Omega decides to surrender herself to spare the people of Pabu, and hoping the Bad Batch can follow her to Tantus. She does catch a plan with Crosshair, and they talk about it, and Crosshair, I wouldn't say he lets her go, but sort of he respects her decision, and he does attempt to plant a tracker, but the shot fails, and CX-2 leaves Pabu with Omega in custody, and we are left with the Bad Batch on Pabu with no Marauder, no ship to get off, and in a pretty bad way. So as I said, you know, we had tragedy in last episode, and we got double tragedy with this one. I suppose let's just go straight to you, Jason. What was your thoughts on the beginning of the action? And, you know, it's pretty fast, this episode. You know, I found that, you know, once CX-2 gets to Pabu, he wastes no time in causing havoc. And, like, I know you're a big fan of the Marauder, for example. So what was your thoughts when you seen that ship go up in flames?
Yeah, this is, this episode for me was like, yeah, this is, it all made sense. It's, you know, let's face it, the Bad Batch are beginning to feel like they're bringing doom and devastation to everyone they come across. And I think everyone that's coming across them is beginning to feel that way. So, you know, the chaos, but then obviously the Bad Batch don't want to get anyone else hurt, so they're going to try and find a way, which made sense. Obviously, it was just a really fast pace and really great episode to set up this huge loss. I don't mean Omega, I mean losing the Marauder. That just devastated me. But no, just kidding. Seeing that ship go up, obviously, I was sort of like, oh, here we go again. Because obviously we lost the Razor Crest, another ship which I loved, and now they've done the same to me with the Marauder. So, you know, and no, I haven't taken the model to pieces and left it as a new replica of how the Marauder stands in Star Wars now. But it was just, it was really, you know, again, it's left them in a desperate state. And as you say, you know, the way that Crosshair's left at the end of this episode, I think, you know, he understands what Omega wanted to do, but the devastation for him as well, you know, Omega's the first one that he's really sort of started a bond with, I think, which is something from the character. We've seen a lot of growth over the last few episodes of as him and Omega have worked together over and over again. And I think that last shot when he realizes that he hasn't made contact with the ship, and, you know, first he's frantically trying to get to a position to make the shot. And we know he's had issues since obviously he's been at Mount Tantus with his shooting and everything. And I think seeing him then miss that, or miss the ship because he couldn't get there in time, and the way he looked, and hats off to the animators for the way they paint these characters, because for me, I felt how devastated and how much of a failure I think he felt at that particular moment. And yeah, for me, it was this whole episode was really, really strong on character building. And that's one of the things I do like about this series in particular, is these characters have gone on some real journeys, and they just seem to keep getting kicked. And Crosshair in particular. To begin with, he wasn't one of the most likable characters, but I think the way he's progressed and that, out of all of them, he's the one that's been through probably the most.
Yeah, I think so. Definitely have sentiments of that. Ian, what was your thoughts on, you know, like I said, quite a tragic episode in the previous episode, then, you know, straight away we're hit with the, we're hitting the gut straight away with the destruction of the Marauder and sort of the way the Empire treat the people of Pabu, which is a planet we've come to know and love, and, you know, quite a peaceful place for the Bad Batch, is now getting turned upside down. Sort of just talk us through your thoughts as all this unfolded in front of your eyes.
Yeah, the one thing that does strike me in this point is this show, more than anywhere, shows how competent the Empire can be. It's no real surprise, because obviously they're led by Republic Commandos, who are obviously the elite soldiers, but obviously in Rebels and stuff like that, the Empire was so often portrayed as quite goofy and couldn't really do anything. So yeah, no, I was quite struck with how competent the Empire are at this point in the timeline, and they are not to be messed with. If they're going to take an objective, they are going to take it. And yeah, I was really struck with that. Obviously, since the Ventress episode, and obviously we've seen stuff in the trailers and that, we knew something was going to happen to Pabu. It is a bit of a heartbreaking story, especially when they left Tex Goggles in his in the big like fort thing in the middle of the town, which was another heartbreaking moment. And it was quite striking how quickly the Empire just swooped in, locked the place down, destroyed all the ships, obviously took out the Marauder, and just devastatingly competent, I would say.
Yeah. And I would say ferocious, like, you know, they're obviously there because, I'm not saying these guys are responsible, but, you know, the Empire lost Omega, and she's the key, it seems like, for this entire project now. So to get her back is like, there's no second choice, there's no second person to get. There's no second target, like it's Omega or bust, it seems like. So, you know, the turn up here and the orders turning the screw straight away. What were your thoughts on, obviously, how they treat the townsfolk? You know, we see the flamethrowers come up, which reminded me of the First Order a little bit, and also of the Lars homestead as well, the New Hope. So what were your thoughts on that, and obviously on Omega sort of making the correct decision for the townsfolk, for our friends, but also I think she does it in hope that, you know, even if Wrecker does or doesn't make the shot, I think she knows that the Bad Batch will come and get her. And I just want your thoughts on that, Ian, as well.
Yeah, like I said, on the Omega's decision, it's obviously something we've seen the character grow with. The Omega we met in season one wouldn't have made that decision. It shows how far that character has come, where she has realised there is no way out. We're not getting away. There's no Marauder to fly off in. If I don't hand myself in, then a lot of people are going to either die or be at least subjugated because of me, and that's not fair. So that shows a true selflessness to the character, and that is the correct decision. And like you said, yeah, I do think she has faith in the Batch coming to find her. They've obviously tried to find her once before and she managed to escape. And I do believe that she will do it again. It was interesting at the end of the episode where obviously she meditated, which was because we don't know. Well, she has got a high M count, and I guess that means she is force sensitive, and we haven't seen her use the force or anything like that. And so it was quite interesting seeing her use those techniques she learned from Gunji in season two. And yeah, just a real moment of pure selflessness from Omega, who's obviously offered us, who's willing to go back to Tantis, who she knows is not a good place for all these people that she wants to help.
Yeah. Are we seeing Omega's got a high M count? Are we seeing Omega's blood lends itself to adding M counts to it? I'm a bit confused about the process, if that makes sense.
I was under the impression that she had a high M count, so that made... that meant she was force sensitive, but I don't know if that's correct, or just how I interpret it.
I think time will tell. Ian, Jason, do you have any thoughts on, obviously, they're not wanting Omega because she's got the force, she's wanting Omega because they want to clone the force, if that makes sense?
Yeah, this is this is the whole, you know, the whole thing with Hemlock is it's about creating a vessel for the Emperor. That is the whole project, basically. Obviously, because they want to be able to bring him back to life if necessary. So I think it's more about whether they can then clone the force sensitivity, but obviously it needs to be a fairly high force sensitivity to be able to be as powerful as the Emperor has been. So I think it's a mixture of both with Omega. But obviously the fact that she's a clone, you know, we're thinking, well, where's this force sensitivity coming from anyway? So it's a whole process and a whole, you know, thing that is quite interesting with the character. And as you, as Ian rightly said, you know, we've watched Omega grow and we've watched her sort of learn. She's discovered who she is, what she is, and, you know, obviously discovered a lot about the real world after leading this very protected life previously on Kamino. So I think it is a whole project. And that's why I'm going to go back to this. I am convinced that CX2 and seeing the name on the screen just a minute ago, I just suddenly thought, I'm still convinced that CX2 is a clone of Crosshair. And I know he said, obviously, you know, but that would have meant the process would have had to been sped up to get him to like that sort of age or to be a working clone. But I think that's also part of the project Necromancer, because obviously in order to create a clone of Palpatine or Sidious, you're going to need to then, they're going to want to get him back to being the Emperor very quickly. So they're going to want a way of, you know, pushing the process on. And I think this is possibly where these assassins have been part of the project as well. So I'm sticking to my guns. I'm convinced CX2 is a clone of Crosshair.
We will find out. Are you making that bet?
That's a clone of Crosshair. I think I've never actually heard that theory before. I kind of like it. I think it makes much more sense than it being tech reanimated. I'm not really a fan of them bringing tech back. I think it makes his sacrifice a bit meaningless if I do that. So I do like that theory, Jason. To be fair, I'd never actually seen the one of it actually being a clone of Crosshair. I will stand with you, mate. I won't take that bet. I think you might be onto something there.
Good stuff. You know, so we had a double dose of tragedy on April 3rd with Identity Crisis and Point of No Return. We come back on April 10th with episode 12, A Juggernaut. Hopefully coming back to something maybe a bit more, less tragic, shall we say. We start off with CX2 Returns to Tantalus with Omega. And, you know, Hemlock's very happy. I like the way Hemlock sort of stands off here and he goes, you know, follow me. And she sort of does, you know, there's a bit of respect going on there as well, I think. Obviously, Amiri Carr tests Omega's blood, confirms that it is what they need. Hemlock takes Omega to be held with the other young Project Necromancer test subjects. Once the Imperial forces leave Pabu, Crosshair suggests to Hunter and Rekka that they get the location of Tantalus from Rampart. He was imprisoned on an Imperial labor camp on Erebus. With Fee's help, they infiltrate Erebus, hijack a prison transfer vehicle, and escape with Rampart. On Fee's ship, Rampart explains that no one knows Tantalus's coordinates, but he is willing to help them find the facility in exchange for not being returned to the labor camp. I suppose there's two things here, and we'll go to you first, Ian. You know, I think the stuff that we see on Tantalus with Amiri Carr, Omega, and Hemlock, and how they interact with each other. That's very interesting. So I don't mind your thoughts on that. But also, you know, we get a bit of a Bad Batch event in Fanchar. Again, you know, the crew end up on Erebus. They need to infiltrate a target. We've seen this a million times before. Obviously, this time it's personal. They need the target for themselves. It is Rampart, someone they know. you know, someone who sort of turned their lives upside down once the Clone Wars come to an end. So what was your thoughts on those sort of on those two dynamics going on in the episode?
I liked the Rampart reveal. It was good to see him back. I mean, he's a total scumbag, but he's an enjoyable one for me. I do like the character, and it's good to see that he hasn't changed. You think time in an Imperial Labour camp would make you humble, but obviously not for the Admiral, which was really cool to see. I did like his beard and his thing. I think the model looked really cool. Also, it did remind me very much of Rogue One, obviously, where they go to the Imperial Labour camp on Mulbani and rescue Jyn Erso to get her out of the Imperial Labour camp. There's also a Juggernaut tank there, which is really cool. So that I thought that was good, and it was interesting to see Crosshair and Rampart interact. Crosshair is not a fan. I think if he could just shoot him and be done with it, I think he would have done it right there and then. But obviously they need him, which is and he knows that. I did that part I really enjoyed with the character as well. He's like, wait a minute, you've come here for me. That must mean you must need me, so I can use this to my advantage. Pure Imperial self-interested move. And I really enjoyed seeing Admiral Rampart back in the show. As for the dynamic between Dr. Carr and Dr. Hemlock, I think that there's a little bit of fear mixed in with loyalty. I think she obviously is very loyal to him because, like she's mentioned before, he gave her, like he saw potential in her, which helps. We still don't know her backstory too much. We know she's a clone, but we don't know her total backstory, which is intriguing. But I also think there's fear there as well. I also think that she is fearful of him and what he may do, obviously, if she doesn't continue to work with him.
Jason, what were your thoughts on sort of, I mean, again, sort of Amiri Kaur, Hemlock and Omega and how they interact with each other? And then also your thoughts on the Bad Batch doing what they do best, infiltrate a target and escaping with them?
Yeah, it's the whole thing at Tantiss is quite interesting. Obviously, Hemlock, sort of, I think he already knows what he's going to find, and the whole process of testing her blood, to me, feels like they're sort of just going through the process. And then it's quite interesting the way I felt as I was watching it. It was more like he was offering to take her to begin with. It looked like he was offering to take her to show her what this thing is. And I think Omega sort of went in there to thinking, right, I'm almost now a spy, you know, about to find out the secrets. And then we, you know, like we said previously, I think even without the tracker, she knows that the Bad Batch are going to be coming in for her. And I think then, like, when she got in there, you sort of get this shock when she realises she's now a prisoner along with all these other youngsters and, you know, that she is now a test subject, which is really quite interesting. And then, obviously, the whole Rampart thing, for me, I was sort of like watching the episode and I was thinking, you know, I'd been told that previously someone gave me a bit of a spoiler. And I'm going to say thank you, Jordan. And he said to me, Rampart's back. And I was like, interesting. So seeing Rampart as a prisoner in this labor camp, you know, it's quite a way for this character to fall. But again, the sort of character he is, it sort of became natural that he's now going to offer his services as a way of surviving. But I wouldn't completely trust him at any point. But I think, you know, like Crosshair and the guys know, that he is a means to an end, and they are desperate for a way to find Omega. And, you know, desperation calls for desperate measures. And it is just, you know, the way they hijack the prison transfer. It is just Bad Batch action, exactly what we'd expect for them. So as an episode goes, there's quite a lot going on in here. You know, you've got quite emotional pieces, and yet at the same time, you've got this whole action side of it. So again, really fun episode.
There was one moment where my heart stopped. And I don't know if you guys noticed this as well, but, you know, once they've, you know, this, they steal the clone turbo tank, the Juggernaut, you know, the rescue Rampart, and then the big part of Zero Feed comes in and takes them out once the call are in. And there's a bit where they've got to jump on board Fee's ship and sort of wreck as the last one to jump across. But there's a moment there where, like, I don't know if it's just me, but I thought maybe he wasn't going to make it, and I had like flashbacks of Tech. I don't know what you thought of that. Ian, was sort of a bit where they didn't pause. It wasn't even a lot of time. There was just one split moment where, like, it almost looked like the gap was getting slightly bigger, maybe, and he was last, and I thought, he's quite big here. What's going to happen? I don't know if you thought that or not.
Yeah, there was some implied jeopardy there. And like you said, it was a very quick moment. We've also seen that moment in the trailer when he jumps, and he's obviously in midair when he jumps and that. Yeah, there was some implied, like, jeopardy in that moment. I did think he'd make it, but there was, like you, there was a little part of me for a split second who thought, oh, hang on, like, he might not, but he does in the end, and he managed. I like how he tossed an unconscious Rampart in the ramp as well. That was quite funny.
Yeah, it was quite good how the man handled that Rampart.
Yeah, they didn't care.
One part I did like was that in the beginning of the episode when Rampart's revealed, he seems to be taking his mask off quite a lot in this area where you're meant to be wearing your mask. I thought it was quite weird. I don't know what your thoughts were on it, Jason.
There were bits where I thought, you know, that, but obviously they needed to reveal who he was, and we needed to see, obviously, he's a very different sort of look to the prim and proper Imperial officer that we're used to. But yeah, there was a little bit, well, what's going on here? You know, shouldn't he be keeping himself covered up? But yeah. And, you know, having him back into the whole sequence is, it's an interesting. It was not who I sort of hadn't thought about Rampart because of his fall from grace. So I'm quite pleased that they found a way to bring him back in. Because let's face it, he's probably got quite a big thing to settle with Darth Sidious or the Emperor as we know it, because he was the one that was betrayed by them.
Definitely. I think, sort of, just wrap this up, I suppose, you know, one thing, obviously, you know, Hemlock now has Omega and Tantus, but I got the impression that maybe we're not going to see, like, the results of the experiment straight away, which probably makes sense because, as we know from The Mandalorian, you know, the Imperial Remnant, you know, 30, 40 years later from this point, are still working on Project Necromancer and don't seem to have it locked down yet. Perhaps that's implied anyway. I don't know what your thoughts were, Ian, on time frames. You know, now that Hemlock has Omega, like, how fast is it before he gets the results the Emperor wants?
I think that'll be for the finale. I think there potentially could be, he's on the verge of creating a, whatever he's creating, whether Snoke or, I'm not sure, anything like that. I think that could be the finale, and then the Batch end up destroying the work. And eventually it's clones that cost the Emperor his plans, which would be fitting because obviously he used the clones for his own devices. It'd be good for them to fire one back at Palpatine.
Yeah, it'd be like his old clones that he's disregarded have destroyed his new clone he hasn't had to use yet. I suppose a lot of irony in there. Go to you, Jason. Any closing thoughts on Juggernaut, and also anything we might have missed on Identity Crisis and Point of No Return that you want to talk about?
The whole three episodes for me have been quite a big journey, big reveal. You know, we've got Omega having been reunited with the Bad Batch, is now back in jeopardy. And the boys are going to be coming, and I think they're going to be pretty determined to make sure that once they've got her back, they're not going to lose her again. So I think, yeah, Rampart and Rampart's going to play quite a big part in the next couple of episodes, I think, in making sure that, that happens. Something I hadn't touched on that you guys mentioned briefly back then was about Tech's goggles, and about Tech definitely be gone. My personal feeling is the loss of Tech is definitely something they wanted to do in season two, and that's carried on. And I think they would know now that they've got to a point that to bring Tech back would just be foolhardy and just fan pleasing. So I'm hoping that I hate to say it, but I hope it, that Tech remains dead and that sacrifice that he made remains his legacy, because I think it's something that's great for the character. And it almost goes back to the Legends era where obviously they killed off Chewie, saving, I think it was Han's kids. So that to me, there was a little bit of reflection going back to that storyline. And I think the character of Tech, who, let's face it, wasn't necessarily... He was a vital part of the Bad Batch, but he was also... He wasn't the traditional military. He was the strategist, the knowledgeable one, you know, and he... the loss of him's been felt throughout this series, I think. And I think that's something that is will remain quite strong in something that the Bad Batch has done that a lot of other series wouldn't do, is give you that heart wrench and say, yeah, we're not going back on this. That was his legacy.
Yeah, and it's very much like Star Wars, where, you know, a character will sacrifice themselves for other characters to get away. You know, if you look at A New Hope, the first Star Wars film, Ben Kenobi sacrifices himself to Vader because he sees Luke and Leia. He finally sees the twins together. They don't know the twins yet, but he sees them together, and he does it so that they'll escape the Death Star. You know, I think we see it in Star Wars Rebels with Kanan Jarrus. You know, he sacrifices himself to save his found family, to save Hera, Sabine, and Ezra in that moment. You know, I think we see it in The Last Jedi, Luke Skywalker. You know, he uses the Force, his greatest trick, to, you know, copy himself across the galaxy. And, you know, he allows the Resistance to escape, but in doing that, he spends all his life energy and passes away and becomes one with the Force. So those are just off the top of my head, you know, without even researching it. You know, we see these characters sort of, you know, you could see Han Solo in Force Awakens, you know. We're not quite sure when he walks onto that bridge to see his son. You know, it's open to interpretation, but I think there's a part of him knows he's probably not coming back from that point, but he does it as sort of a last chance to help his son, or even give his son the slightest doubt. He does it, if that makes sense. So I think it's, you know, you don't see many other shows and other, you know, other stories, but I think in Star Wars it's something where a sacrifice can be something that's so important and so vital and something that you don't get back. And I think Tech very much falls into that category. So it'll be interesting to see should that be proved right or wrong, I suppose. Ian, any closing thoughts on this episode, Juggernaut? And on the previous two episodes, Identity Crisis and Point of No Return, that we haven't covered and you want to talk about?
No, I love the tank action. It's very much something I would have done as a kid. I love playing with like toys and all that type of thing. So I really love the action with the Juggernauts. It's one of my favourite designs in Star Wars. I've loved it ever since Revenge of the Sith when we first saw it. So it was good to see that back again. It was good to see them bash each other and take each other out. It was really cool. Other than that, no, just like Jason said, really, these episodes have been quite a journey, and it is gearing us up towards a very intriguing finale, and I still don't know what's going to happen and that. So it's really hitting stride, the Bad Batch, in this final season.
Definitely, I feel, you know, like obviously two of these episodes aired on the same day, so they were designed to watch back to back, that is Identity Crisis and Point of No Return. But I do feel as a trio, you know, Identity Crisis, Point of No Return, and Juggernaut sort of flow very well as, like, you know, really good to watch a sort of one chapter altogether. So I'm sort of glad that we are reviewing them that way. I think from diving into them here and speaking to you guys about it, they know that you are very connected. So yeah, that brings us on to talk about the future, I suppose. There's 3 episodes left of The Bad Batch. So the next episode airs on April 17th. That is Into the Breach. Then there is the penultimate episode, which airs on April 24th, which is Flash Strike. And then we have not only the season 3 finale, but the finale of The Bad Batch, which airs on May the 1st. And that is The Cavalry Has Arrived. I suppose let's just go to you first, Jason. What's your thoughts and hopes and expectations and excitement levels like for these final 3 episodes and the end of The Bad Batch?
Yeah, it's like Ian said previously, I think this is, you know, these 3 episodes are going to be massive, and we're going to see the end of The Bad Batch, as it's so. And I know how I think I want it to end, and it's not necessarily a way that you want most shows to end, but I want them to draw a line under these characters, because it makes sense then why we've never seen them, you know, in any of the other stuff. Obviously they were created after it all happened, but you know, I don't want them to suddenly be, well, they could have been here, they could have been there, you know. I want a definitive answer almost. Obviously being a huge animation fan, for me, there's the sadness of ending of another series. I certainly will miss this series, unlike Resistance. But at the same time, I'm pretty certain there will be another animated series that, and I think it's going to follow in similar vein, because I think they've learned now that they've had so much success with Clone Wars, with Rebels, and now The Bad Batch. I know some people say, oh, it hasn't been as successful as its predecessors, but for me, it's told a different story from the same series. And I've enjoyed it, everything we've seen so far. There's not many episodes that I look at this series and I look at the episodes over the last 3 seasons, and there's not many that I would say, yeah, you can give that one a miss. The story has been very, very well, you know, crafted. And I think 3 seasons is a trilogy, so you've got the beginning, the middle and the end. It's flowed perfectly. I think they've done a wise thing, and I'm looking forward to seeing where the story goes.
And to you, Ian, as well, obviously, like I said, 3 episodes left, you know, Into the Breach, Flash Strike, The Cavalry Has Arrived, and then the Bad Batch series will be no more. Just your thoughts, expectations, and your hype levels for the final 3 episodes of this awesome series.
Really excited. I think eventually we will get to Tantis. The clones will be broken free and they will get away. I think obviously Dr. Hemlock will die. And yeah, no, I couldn't agree more with Jason what he said about the show. Apart from Resistance, I like Resistance. I like Resistance as a guilty pleasure. Just usually excited to see where the story goes and where we potentially could move after the show as well, like what the next animated show will be in the future.
I've got a couple of questions for you now, so I just need you to reply with live or die, okay?
Yeah.
So I'm going to go to you first, Ian. So live or die. So Hemlock, live or die?
Die.
Jason, Hemlock, live or die?
I'm going to say live.
Okay. Amiri Carr, live or die? You, Ian?
Live.
Jason? Yes.
Die.
Okay. Omega, live or die? Ian?
Live. I think so.
Jason?
I'm going to say live, but it's not necessarily what I want.
Okay.
Jesus.
Ian, Hunter, live or die?
Die.
Jason?
Yeah, I think die.
Crosshair, live or die, Ian?
Live.
Jason?
Yeah, I'm going to go with Ian on that. I think he's going to live.
And probably a sad one for you, Jason. We're going to go with, obviously, Wrecker, Live or Die.
Ian, Live or Die?
I reckon he will live. I don't think they'll kill Wrecker off, to be fair.
Jason, you?
Again, I'm gonna go with Ian on that. I think he's going to live, but I'm almost gutted. I almost think for the story, he should die.
We will see. We will see, won't we? I think that's pretty much. I've got no more talking points to discuss about the Bad Batch so far. Are you guys all clear?
Yeah, I'm good.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So we'll go to you first, Ian, about just something different, I suppose. Just you've been purchasing many Star Wars things recently. Have any arrived, or is it just all pre-orders?
I have got the new book from John Jackson Miller, The Living Force. However, I've only read about 20 pages at the moment because I've been busy. But I'm looking forward to getting into that. I was up in Newcastle yesterday. I did walk past Forbidden Planet after the game, and I was intrigued to go in, but I'm coming back up next weekend, so I will probably buy some stuff when I'm in Newcastle next weekend.
Fantastic stuff. What about you, Jason? Any Star Wars purchases, any pre-orders, anything you've seen yet you've got your eye on?
There's always plenty of stuff that I've seen. Obviously, we've had some quite nice Lego reveals. I think I'm going to go for the Brickheads Commander Cody. I also really like the Droid car. I think that's a really cool model. I've personally recently received some rather cool stuff via Jedi News. In that I've got some Roosevelt's shirts, one of which I'm wearing at this precise moment, which is the very cool R2-D2. And I also got sent a couple of really nice, baseball caps. And I'm not normally a fan of wearing baseball caps, but these two have become my favourite. One's the R2-D2 and one's the 40th anniversary from Empire Strikes Back hat. I'm really pleased with them. I have a feeling I may have another delivery coming that I'm going to look forward to revealing. I've also recently picked up, I've had a visit to my good friend Ben down in Jedi Archives, and I picked up, he's kindly given me the Star Wars Unlimited starter. So I've got to have a go with that. I'm going to try and organise a little competition with someone locally who I need to catch up with a few beers and some role play game. I think that'll be a bit of fun because he's a bit of a gamer. And so I've been really lucky the last few weeks. A few bits that I'm looking out for. I want to try and get back into my reading. So got a few things that I want to possibly purchase from Amazon, and as I say, I'm looking forward to what I think I've got coming very soon.
Awesome stuff. For me personally, Star Wars Unlimited, sort of what I've been purchasing, you can see me sort of opening packs, ripping packs of Star Wars Unlimited, the new trading card game from Fantasy Flight Games. On our TikTok, just search Star Wars Podcast on TikTok and you'll see that. Obviously, a lot more to come on there. No new figures for me, although I've got a lot on it open. And again, they'll probably be coming to TikTok and YouTube, so stay tuned to that. But I think that brings an end to an awesome Bad Batch filled episode of Star Wars. Ian, where can the people find you on social media? Looks like Ian's gone. Jason, where can the people find you on social media?
At Hondo Ling, as always.
Ian, where can people find you on social media?
I am at Star Wars Ian on X.
There we go. You can find myself on X and Instagram at Geordie Jedi Pete. You can also find the podcast on X at Boz Star. You can also find the podcast on, as I said, X, TikTok, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn at Star Wars Podcast. If you are listening on Apple Music or on Spotify, please leave us a top review, you know, a 5-star review. We love your little sentence saying how much you love the podcast. Makes us all smile for a long time, only takes you a few moments, and it also helps people find the show. And again, if you're listening on any of the other wonderful podcast applications out there, there is a lot now, and it has the feature to leave a review. Again, just leave a top review, all the stars, nice little sentence, and again, makes us smile a long time, helps people find the show, and it's your good deed for the day, which will allow Santa Claus to visit you in December. So please do that. That brings into a fantastic episode. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining me. Listeners, thank you very much for listening. May the force be with you all. And remember, always tell that to Kanja Club.
The Dorky Diva Show presents...
Why is this seat so much more comfortable?
The long-awaited sequel to the adventures of the Zolandart audio drama.
Have you seen the captain's datapad?
Trying to work, Murph.
Piloting the Zolandart by himself...
You do understand the details of this particular job, correct?
I've been on plenty of jobs like this. With you!
Reldar Saias returns to a planet he thought he'd left behind for good.
Is there a reason you didn't mention I was tagging along?
Hopefully having you there will make others think twice about messing with me.
Making new friends.
Oh, you must be the pilot of the Zolandart, yes?
I guess I am.
And reconnecting with old ones.
Reldar?
Vera?
What are you doing here?
Until past grudges resurface.
I'd be minding my own business if I were you.
Well, if your business wasn't being handled right in front of my face, maybe I could mind my own business. We have to leave. Now.
Why the rush all of a sudden?
We're in trouble.
If it isn't little Reldar Saias.
Hey, Yorick. Long time no see.
Rose already knows you're here.
Oh.
Look who decided to come home.
Reldar must confront his origin.
I must admit, I never saw this as being a part of your past, Softshell.
Or let it define his future.
I will get what is owed to me, no matter the cost.
Because what Roz is trying to do is wrong.
Says you.
My blasters. We're going to need these. Take that, Sleemo.
Who do you think you are?
The Adventures of the Zolandart, Episode 2, coming soon.